This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Deborah Weinstein reading the first hour of USA Today on Monday, April 29th, 2024. Our first article is Protesters Face Police Crackdowns Across USA. Hundreds demonstrating against Israel arrested. This is written by Mina Arshad, Michael Loria, and Kayla Jimenez. Chicago. Summer Papichin and 200 other activist students at Northwestern University had just set up more than two dozen tents and tarps on the picturesque university lawn. The mood in the morning was calm. Students brought Palestinian flags and drums to play for passing cars honking support. Then the cops showed up to shut them down. We thought, it's Northwestern University. They have a liberal reputation to uphold. But they came within minutes, Papichin said of Thursday's confrontation. Campus police began removing tents, but left after about 100 protesters linked arms and formed a barricade. Papichin and thousands of other student protesters around the nation have seen an unexpected side of their colleges, what they consider a militarized response to basic civil rights and free speech. From California to New York, from Texas to Illinois, hundreds of students have been arrested after college presidents called police, some in riot gear and some carrying tear gas, to remove their own students from encampments on campus quads. Some question whether authorities are overreacting. Others question the priorities of academic leaders who sic the police on them. At Northwestern, Papichin, a 25-year-old grad student, said organizers quickly conferred with protesters at Columbia University in New York, an epicenter of growing student dissent against the Israel-Hamas war, on how to handle police if they returned. We'll see if they're interested in arresting their own students and employees, Papichin said. By nightfall, more than 500 protesters had gathered on the lawn, and she was telling students through a bullhorn what to do if they were arrested. The student-made tent cities that have been at the heart of the Israel-Hamas protest conflicts have sprouted up at several universities, most notably Columbia. For college presidents, the encampments are often seen as an intimidating presence and interruption of life on campus. I fully support the importance of free speech, respect the right to demonstrate, and recognize that many of the protesters have gathered peacefully, Columbia University President Manoush Shafik said in an email sent last week to all students and faculty that was obtained by USA Today. However, the encampment raises serious safety concerns, disrupts campus life, and has created a tense and at times hostile environment for many members of our community. It is essential that we move forward with a plan to dismantle it. At UCLA, Students for Justice in Palestine set up an encampment Thursday on Royce Quad. We're not leaving until our demands are met, the group said in an Instagram post. Also in Los Angeles, the University of Southern California declared its campus closed and asked the LA Police Department to clear a demonstration after it arrested 94 people linked to a protest Wednesday. Protest organizers say the police responses across the nation are overzealous. At the University of Texas at Austin on Wednesday, state troopers in riot gear and police on horseback broke up a protest at the school hosted by the student group Palestine Solidarity Committee. Nearly 60 people were booked into the Travis County Jail in connection to the protest, Travis County Sheriff's Office spokesperson Kristen Dark said. In a statement, the group, concerned UT Austin faculty, decried what it called the decision by administrative leaders to invite city and state police on horses, motorcycles, and bicycles in riot gear and armed with batons, pepper spray, tear gas, and guns to our campus today to interrupt a peaceful student event. The event was to have included teach-ins, study sessions, pizza, and an art workshop, the statement said. There was no threat of violence, no plan to disrupt classes, no intimidation of the campus community. Instead of allowing our students to go ahead with their peaceful planned action, our leaders turned our campus into a militarized zone. Some faculty members and students are calling for the removal of University of Texas President Jay Hartzell, saying the police response and invitation to bring them to campus went too far. Polly Strong, the president of the UT chapter of the American Association of University Professors, called on faculty to sign a petition of no confidence in Hartzell. The president has shown himself to be unresponsive to urgent faculty, staff, and student concerns. He has violated our trust, the petition said. The university is no longer a safe and welcoming place for the diverse community of students and scholars who, until now, have called this campus home. Will Creeley, legal director of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, said the nonpartisan civil liberties group had received requests for assistance since UT Austin's response to student demonstrators. Since joining FIRE in 2006, Creeley told USA Today he has never seen such a stark law enforcement response to student expression. Adding a lot of law enforcement officers to a peaceful protest, it's easy to imagine how that goes south. It's harder to imagine how that goes right, Creeley said. Some conservative commentators disagreed and applauded the Texas police response. The protest Wednesday at the University of Texas Austin was a prime example, illustrating the difference between how red states and blue states handle respect for the rule of law. Red states meet such challenges with strength, as seen in the cases of Texas Governor Greg Abbott and UT Austin's President Jay Hartzell, blogger Laura Wellington wrote in a commentary for the Western Journal, a conservative news site. Blue states take quite the opposite approach. They've taught young people to disrespect the rule of law by ensuring there are zero consequences. So now the young militants are running roughshod over Columbia University, New York University, and Yale University, among many others, Wellington wrote. Columbia University's private school status leaves little room for legal recourse from groups that object to the administration's response, First Amendment experts say. Students and faculty at most private schools don't have the same protections as those at public schools. Columbia can restrict First Amendment rights. They can restrict what students say and what they protest, said Kevin Goldberg, an expert in First Amendment rights at the Freedom Forum, a national group that advocates for First Amendment protections. Still, Columbia's decision to suspend students, send in state police officers to shutter demonstrations and arrest protesters, was a pretty dramatic escalation of common practice at campuses across the nation, said Angus Johnston, an adjunct assistant professor at Hostos Community College of the City University of New York and a historian of student activism. The Columbia Spectator, a student newspaper, reported the response to its encampments last week marked the first time that mass arrests were made on campus since 1968, when NYPD arrested hundreds of students protesting the Vietnam War. The shift that's happened is not a shift in student tactics, but a shift in administration response, he said. After Kent State and Jackson State in 1970, there was a period of about 30 years or so where it tended to be fairly unlikely that campuses would respond with mass arrests, even in the case of admin building occupations. College students today, including Jewish students, are not at the level of support for the government of Israel that we see in their parents or grandparents. And a large group of college politicians and administrators and donors are all lined up on the other side. This is creating a situation in which students feel justified in their protest, and administrators feel justified in their response, Johnston said. There was a wave of mass arrests in response to the Occupy movement in the early 2000s. But when university police pepper sprayed demonstrators on the University of California Davis campus, and the incident made national headlines, the trend bucked, Johnston noted. It caused a lot of colleges to dial back their tactics again, he said. In recent years, it's not unheard of to have arrests, but to do so quickly, with mass suspensions and arrests of so many students at one time, felt very much like a precipitous escalation. At Northwestern University, undergraduate student Mayan Alvarado Goldberg said she was present when cops first came to the encampment tents to take the encampment tents down Thursday morning. To be honest, it was a little scary, said the 22-year-old whose sister is planning to camp out at a California student protest. I don't think the cops need to be here at all, she said, pointing to nearby people eating carryout kebab. But given the confrontation in the morning, she had one comment if police returned and arrests were made. I guess it shows even peaceful protests will be met with violence. Our next article is Mexico puts dent in illegal crossings. Its migrant busing program makes U.S. harder to reach. This is written by Lauren Villagran. Piedras Negras, Mexico. It took Anna Elizabeth Melgar 4 tries to reach the U.S. border. Each time she made her way north, Mexican immigration authorities caught her and bused her south. Not to her home country of El Salvador, but to a city in southern Mexico. If you catch me and I'm a migrant, send me back to my country, she said, while resting in a Catholic shelter in this Mexican border town across from Eagle Pass, Texas. I get it. I don't belong here. But what is this nonsense that you're sending me south in Mexico? It's illogical. The Biden administration and Texas are taking credit for an unusual springtime lull in illegal border crossings, with the White House touting its legal pathways, and Governor Greg Abbott championing his troops and concertina wire. But analysts, immigrant advocates, and migrants themselves say it's Mexico blocking the path north. Mexico President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's immigration agency has intensified a busing program that aims to hurt migrants' chances of reaching the U.S., or at least delay their arrival by apprehending them on highways, train routes, and airports, and shipping them to the southernmost part of his country. López Obrador is likely motivated by economic interests. Last fall, a surge of hundreds of thousands of migrants flooding the southwestern United States created a hurdle to trade between Mexico and the U.S., its largest trading partner by far. Immigrant advocates say the policy drives vulnerable people into the arms of smugglers. Migrants report being extorted en routes north, only to be intercepted at checkpoints and returned to southern Mexico to do it all again. The Mexican government is busing people in circles, said Andrew Seeley, executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Migration Policy Institute. The numbers aren't down because of busing in Texas, he said. The numbers are down because of busing in Mexico. U.S. Customs and Border Protection reported fewer than 189,372 migrant encounters in March, down slightly from 189,914 in February, during a time when migration typically starts to spike. Encounters were lower than normal through the first 10 days of April, too, according to congressional testimony. The drop bucked historical seasonal trends and was only the second time this century that encounters declined from February to March, said Adam Isaacson, Director of Defense Oversight for the Washington Office on Latin America. The busing program is a response, analysts say, to the surge in migrants arriving from Venezuela and other countries where Mexico, like the U.S., can't easily return people. Mexico's Foreign Ministry, Interior Ministry, and Immigration Agency, the Instituto Nacional de Migración, didn't respond to requests for comment. Mexico's crackdown is evident in the number of migrant encounters resulting in a person being detained or placed in a shelter, but not deported. These encounters ballooned to more than 726,000 in 2023, according to Mexico's Interior Ministry, from fewer than 179,000 in 2021. In January and February alone, Mexico reported more than 230,000 encounters with migrants who were placed in detention or shelters and then released. Melgar was among them. On a recent Tuesday in April, while migrants milled about the shelter or ate breakfast, she sat alone on a courtyard bench and smiled. After more than 4 months of trying, she had made it to the U.S. border. While Melgar rested, the nun in charge, Sister Isabel Turcios, led a group of American women on a tour. Medical volunteers set up an outdoor clinic in the courtyard. There were 108 migrants sheltered that day. Hardly any compared with last year, Turcios said. In December, thousands had arrived daily in Piedras Negras and other points south of the border. That month, on the U.S. side, Customs and Border Protection reported its highest ever one-month tally of migrant encounters, 301,981. That month, Presidents Biden and López Obrador had a phone call in which they discussed additional enforcement actions, and Biden dispatched a high-level team of negotiators to Mexico City. By mid-April, the checkpoints had multiplied. Mexican authorities had set up at least 6 immigration checkpoints between Monterrey and the border at Piedras Negras, according to Turquía's conversations with migrants. It had become onerous even for her, a nun from El Salvador, to travel overland. The authorities got together and decided more checkpoints, more buses to take the migrants south, she said. The numbers started to go down for that reason and because they were rounding them up. Texas numbers haven't been going down because of the barbed wire, she said. The migrants who make it through Mexico's checkpoints keep passing under the wire. That same day, across the Rio Grande in Eagle Pass, Texas, the state's first border czar, Mike Banks, climbed up the sloped riverbank to address his troops in Shelby Park, the city park that has become ground zero in the state's public battle with the Biden administration over border enforcement. Banks shouldered past reams of concertina wire and got nicked on the way. The 3 tiny cuts on his upper forearm were evidence, he said, of the difference between concertina wire that grabs the skin and razor wire that slices through it. It was a lesson in the tactical infrastructure that he says is deterring illegal border crossings in Texas. I will tell you that right now, if it wasn't for what we're doing in the state of Texas, you wouldn't see our numbers the way they are, Banks told USA Today. Texas is taking credit for the dip in migration along the state's 1,254-mile border with Mexico. Banks, a former Border Patrol agent, and his boss, Governor Greg Abbott, say the state's $11 billion operation Lone Star is working. and the numbers prove it. Texas registered a sharper drop in migrant crossings in the first 3 months of the year than the border did as a whole, according to CBP statistics, while California saw crossings increase. This entire sector is averaging a couple of hundred migrants a day versus 4,000 to 6,000 just in this park last year, Banks said, referring to Border Patrol's Del Rio sector. So the deterrence is working, and look, Texas is going to protect Texas. Other Republican-led states are pitching in. 16 states have sent troops or law enforcement officers to support Operation Lone Star, according to a spokesman for the governor's office. The state has also aimed to export the border crisis across the country. Abbott's Operation Lone Star has bused more than 112,700 migrants to Democrat-led cities nationwide. In Texas, migrants are offered the bus rides and go voluntarily. In Mexico, authorities give them no choice. During his recent visit to Eagle Pass, Banks, who advises the governor, addressed a circle of camouflage-clad agents of Florida's Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. He joked with a group of Texas Highway Patrolmen as they took a break from the heat in a shade tent where two stray dogs napped. The river was quiet, but for two Honduran men who had been at Turquia's shelter earlier that day, they waded along the U.S. bank looking for a spot to clamber up through the concertina wire. Melgar, a mother of three, worked as a seamstress in Costa Rica for years, making money she couldn't earn in El Salvador. But she returned to her country when work dried up. In December, under pressure to pay for her now teenage children's education, she left for Mexico with her sights set on the U.S. Mexican immigration agents clad in brown uniforms first picked up Melgar in the colonial city of Puebla in southern Mexico, she said. The second time, they intercepted her in the northern factory town of Torreon. The third time, they caught her in Monterrey, a wealthy business hub south of Texas. Each time, she was bused back to a migrant detention center in southern Mexico, held for a few days, and then released, she said. On her fourth attempt, she skirted multiple Mexican checkpoints by riding atop a cargo train and walking for miles through arid desert. She spent days and days and nights of cold, heat, hunger, and thirst, she said. Melgar said she applied for an appointment to cross the border lawfully via the CBP One app, but she hasn't received one yet. I'm waiting, she said in a WhatsApp message last week while still at the shelter. God willing, it will come soon. Mexico's immigration crackdowns rarely last as long as they have this time. The reality is that Mexico has made it harder for people to get to South Texas, said Aaron Reichland Melnick, policy director at the American Immigration Council. It's this broad shift as a result of Mexican enforcement, one we might see breaking down. Already, there are signs of a breakdown along the U.S.-Mexico border, nearly 500 miles northwest of the Eagle Pass Piedras Negras crossing. Migrants have been reaching Ciudad Juarez, across from El Paso, Texas, in larger numbers in recent days, and tension at this border crossing has grown. The El Paso Border Patrol sector has seen average daily migrant encounters tick up slightly from 940 earlier this month to 1,025 as of Friday. Earlier this month, more than 140 migrants breached reams of concertina wire on the El Paso side of the Rio Grande and confronted Texas troops. A local grand jury indicted the migrants on misdemeanor riot participation charges, according to the district attorney. Then last week, a cargo train hailing from the outskirts of Mexico rumbled into Ciudad Juarez with hundreds of men, women, and children atop its boxcars. If the train stopped at the military and immigration checkpoint outside the city at all, the authorities let it go. Adults held fast to the children or shaded them under blankets until the train slowed, and the migrants climbed down blocks from the U.S. border to decide their next move. Contributing to this article was Omar Ornelas of the El Paso Times. Our next article is the first story in a series called Campaign Whisperers, an occasional series that takes an in-depth look at the aspiring presidential candidates, lawmakers, and officials President Joe Biden and his re-election team have chosen to act as surrogates, working to address dissent, smooth out tensions, and ultimately get swing voters to cast a ballot for Biden. California congressman works to steer frustrated voters to Biden. He courts progressives and students in swing states. This is written by Francesca Chambers. Las Vegas. Tanner Hale did not hold back. We cannot run a campaign that's wrapped in bubble wrap. President Joe Biden's unwillingness to have a public discussion about U.S.-Israel policy vis-a-vis the Palestinian death toll in Gaza is fueling consternation among young voters, the 27-year-old Democratic organizer warned. Climate change, reproductive rights, threats to democracy are all going by the wayside in the 2024 campaign. This is the most difficult job I've ever had personally, organizing youth for a cycle, said Hale, the executive director of the Young Democrats of Nevada. For much of the roundtable, Ro Khanna, a Biden campaign surrogate and 47-year-old California congressman, sat quietly, leaning forward in his seat with his hands clasped. But when Khanna asked whether Biden's State of the Union address made a difference, the president said protecting Palestinian lives must be a priority. Or did you think it was not enough? Khanna asked the 10 young Democrats. Jessica Guerra, 34, jumped in with a rebuff. Voters will not be satisfied until their elected officials show up to talk about what's happening in the Middle East. Isn't that what he's doing there now? Khanna prodded. Respectfully, Congressman Guerra begins. Khanna is not a representative from Nevada, she notes. You're not Biden. Guerra has a point. Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris have come to the state a total of 7 times since the October 7th Hamas attack against Israel. The economy, gun violence, health care, and abortion rights, all on the agenda. At no point had either of them come to the swing state to discuss the Mideast conflict with voters. And so Khanna has taken it upon himself to soothe disappointed Democrats, frustrated young voters, embittered Arab Americans, and disillusioned progressives in states that will decide the general election, a likely rematch between Biden and former President Donald Trump. A quasi-Biden campaign official, Khanna operates in a gray area. Khanna is among a group of surrogates the campaign has identified to address dissent, smooth out tensions, and ultimately steer wayward Democrats back toward the president. Sometimes he acts as a liaison between the president's team and pockets of the party's base. More often than not, he sets up listening sessions for himself with the help of outside political consultants. Khanna insists all the trips are done in coordination with Biden's campaign, that they wanted him to meet with young people while in Nevada. This is a thing that the Biden campaign has asked me to do when I go out to these places, is to reach out, Khanna said, during a car ride in Las Vegas from the roundtable with young voters. It can be hard to tell when Khanna is pitching himself and when the Biden campaign is asking him to travel. He is always eager to go. Khanna began a campaign-approved college tour for Biden this month in Wisconsin. He hopes to add more dates in May. The Biden campaign says it is in regular communication with his team about travel and events, including the ones in Wisconsin and Nevada, and a late February trip to Michigan. Khanna hoped to quell anger among Arab Americans at the president in Michigan. Community leaders who refused to meet with campaign officials agreed to sit down with Khanna. The congressman who sits on Biden's National Advisory Board says he was there in a personal capacity. Khanna says he went on his own because he didn't want to risk his meetings being canceled. Then there's the time Khanna came to the president's rescue in New Hampshire. Khanna stumped in the state on behalf of an independent write-in campaign when Biden was prohibited by party rules from appearing on the ballot, again in his personal capacity. A former co-chair of Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, the Indian American lawmaker has become something of a progressive darling. Fewer people recall that before he was elected, Khanna worked for Barack Obama. He is hardly recognizable outside of Washington, a point that is not lost on Khanna. He readily gave a USA Today reporter unfettered access to his schedule in Nevada. For some in Biden's orbit, Khanna's moves are attention-seeking. To them, the lackluster enthusiasm the president is experiencing among some voting blocs is not symptomatic of broader divisions inside his base. For the activists and party officials on the ground in the battleground states, however, Khanna's willingness to pinpoint and address Biden's weaknesses is a welcome relief. While Khanna disagrees with Biden on Gaza, he sends an important signal to people that you can be opposed to Biden's policy with respect to Israel and Palestine and still support his reelection in the face of Trump, former Sanders campaign manager Jeff Weaver said. There's no denying the relatively young congressman is testing the waters for a future White House bid of his own. He's quick to tout his relationship with South Carolina kingmaker and civil rights icon Jim Clyburn. Khanna has an event planned with him in September. It was a bitter 25 degrees outside in New Hampshire. Khanna, who was born in Pennsylvania, did his undergrad at the University of Chicago and got his law degree at Yale, had forgotten his boots and his gloves. But at least he'd remembered to bring Dunkin' Donuts. A small group affiliated with the write-in Biden campaign had gathered in the snow at a traffic circle to wave signs supporting the president. Khanna was their star attraction. Biden had picked a messy fight with the state and was shunning it ahead of the primary. He wasn't going to appear on the ballot. Khanna put himself out on a limb. He helped fundraise. He appeared on a call for volunteers. He campaigned in the most frigid part of the state. He bet that Biden would win. And he was right. Biden won with nearly 80,000 votes. That was just stupid not to have boots, the California congressman said. The gloves didn't really bother me, but the boots, you're freezing. You freeze, so next time we'll definitely have boots. Bracing the elements wasn't nearly as tough as other challenges Khanna has overcome. He lost his first bid for Congress. A decade later, he lost again, before winning on his third try. He was inspired by his grandfather, Amarnath Vidyalankar, who was imprisoned for 4 years as part of the same movement that landed Mahatma Gandhi in jail. Vidyalankar died when Khanna was a child, but the future lawmaker grew up hearing stories about his fight for Indian independence. He's willing to go wherever we need him, not where he wants to go. K.R. Epstein, the Manchester lead for the write-in Biden campaign, said of Khanna. Khanna is building out an organization similar to the one that won Sanders the state twice, one he knows well because he was part of it. He's headlined fundraisers for New Hampshire Young Democrats. He's done training sessions for their candidates for local office. More than once, he's been the special guest at major state party functions. He's stumped for vulnerable lawmakers. We're calling him the fifth member of New Hampshire's congressional delegation, said Jay Bowie, a 26-year-old Manchester resident and president of the New Hampshire Young Democrats. Connor found himself staring down a different kind of write-in campaign in Michigan. Biden had pushed for Michigan to vote earlier than the brouhaha over which state would hold the first Democratic primary of 2024. Now, a large portion of the state's primary electorate, including the only Palestinian-American congresswoman, was about to use that power to abandon him over his full-fledged support for Israel. One of the state's top elected Democrats, House Majority Floor Leader Abram Ayush, met with White House advisors. It didn't make much of a difference, and Ayush declined an offer to sit down with Biden's campaign. Yet he agreed to see Khanna. Ayush said he thought the Democratic congressman could get through to the president's aides. Khanna listened and asked questions. Ayush still voted uncommitted, but he came away confident that Khanna understood that the Biden campaign could not scare people into voting against Trump. I think after leaving Michigan, Roe really understood that that is not the case, that the amount of pain and frustration people have had is not something that would go away, Ayush said. The problem that has the potential to upend 2024 has chased Biden across the Great Lakes region. More than 45,000 people voted uncommitted in Minnesota. Nearly 48,000 people voted uninstructed in Wisconsin. The protest vote exceeded 100,000 people in Michigan. The president's reelection campaign has responded by downplaying the magnitude of the disapproval. For these voters, the furor with Biden goes beyond a mere difference in opinion. They see a dissonance between Biden, born almost a year after Pearl Harbor, when Jews were being persecuted by Hitler, and younger generations of Americans. They say Biden's outrage at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu isn't enough. Khanna was not initially for an immediate ceasefire. He changed his position early in the war, but not before his political director quit 2 weeks into his job over the matter. He'll turn an issue over in his mind several times, and he's constantly updating his perspective on it, said Abdul El-Sayed, 39, a public health professional from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and former gubernatorial candidate. Congressional Progressive Caucus Chair Pramila Jayapal, one of the earliest U.S. lawmakers to call for a ceasefire, says she spoke to Khanna quite a bit before he backed one. We often in the Democratic Party treat young people and our base of progressive voters as if they should just know better and they should just come along and vote for a Democrat because the Republican would be much worse, Jayapal said. And I really think that's the wrong approach. Jayapal, who actively helped build the Progressive Coalition for Biden in 2020, said that under the current conditions, it will prove extremely difficult to turn them out in November. This is the critical issue, and we've got to see a policy shift if we're going to be able to bring back that fragile coalition, she warned. Khanna says he's seen a shift in Biden's approach to Israel recently. The U.S. allowed a U.N. resolution calling for a permanent ceasefire to move forward by abstaining from the vote. I do think the president is getting closer to my position, he said in an interview. Biden may not have come as far as young voters want, he told the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, at a ceasefire discussion that took place later that day with students. But at least he has the sitting president's ear. Khanna says he talks to the president for a couple of minutes every 3 to 4 months. He's talked much more extensively to Biden's senior-most advisors. Khanna said he perceives the uncommitted vote in Michigan as being a wake-up call for the president on Gaza. Yet it's far from unsettled how the dispute will play out in most must-win swing states, such as Michigan, Wisconsin, and Nevada in the general election. Nevada will be a bellwether for Biden. The state almost always votes for the presidential winner, and in every current public poll of the state, Trump is leading Biden. Khanna says Biden's campaign can't avoid engaging with young voters on their own turf. The president, vice president, and their surrogates should hold open town halls in every college town in America, he says. Khanna's roundtable with young Democrats in Nevada had more of a focus group feel. His approach has even caught the eye of longtime GOP pollster Frank Luntz. He understands, reflects, and communicates progressive voter public opinion better than anyone, Luntz said in a recent X post. Harris did a college tour last fall, but her team screened students and handpicked questions that fit with their narrative instead of the moderated chats. Khanna says he'll continue his listening tour, but young voters are insisting on hearing from Biden and Harris. I mean, look at Obama. Can you imagine if Obama was running in 2012 and he didn't go to college campuses? His first official event of the March trip to Nevada was Shepherd's Breakfast, a monthly gathering of power brokers in the Black faith community. The announcer mispronounced his name. Khanna. He got it right with some help. If it bothered Khanna, it didn't show. Khanna recounted how Gandhi's technique of nonviolent political protest inspired Martin Luther King Jr.'s King's Movement, paved the way for the 1965 Immigration Act, which lifted a de facto ban on Asian migration, he explained. If it weren't for the civil rights movement, my parents wouldn't have been allowed to come to the United States of America, he said. The history lesson draws applause. Khanna tells the audience about the fellowships he's creating for Black students at tech companies and a bill he introduced to prevent private equity firms from buying up homes in their communities. He closes by telling them that he volunteered on Obama's very first campaign in Chicago when the future president was running for state senate. He later worked for him as a deputy assistant secretary at the Commerce Department. People don't realize Obama appointed a lot of people like me in their 30s to give us a shot, he said. Kiana Fleming, 36, a full-time student and single mother, had never heard of Khanna before the Las Vegas breakfast, but she came away impressed. When he spoke, he made me feel a little better about Biden, she said. Although much of the recent focus on Khanna has been on the Israel-Hamas war, he says economic policy is where he's had the biggest influence on Biden's agenda. He was one of the lawmakers standing with Biden at the CHIPS and Science Act signing celebration on the South Lawn. The law incorporated measures Khanna pushed for to help reduce the trade deficit with China. His work scored him an invitation to Ohio to help Biden promote the legislation. Roe is a tireless champion for American innovation and seeing that workers are part of the deal, Biden said at the signing. Ronna Epting, executive director of Move On, one of the nation's largest progressive groups, noted how Khanna was able to get climate provisions that progressives wanted in the Inflation Reduction Act by working with moderate Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. he's able to lead in a way that doesn't marginalize folks within the party, even though they may not agree with him, Epting said. Biden campaign spokesman Charles Lutvak called Khanna an invaluable partner in talking to voters about issues such as student loan debt, climate change, and economic opportunity. He's working alongside 50 National Advisory Board members that will be on the ground campaigning tirelessly across the battlegrounds over the next 7 months, Lutvak said in a statement. Khanna is appealing to much of the same voting bloc Sanders galvanized in his presidential bids. He also attracts former Obama voters and is palatable to Republicans. The Silicon Valley lawmakers' support for TikTok in the face of a potential U.S. ban has also helped to raise his profile with younger voters. Khanna denied that he'd want a cabinet position in the second Biden term. At a House party in New Hampshire, Khanna dodged a question about whether he would consider running. "Who knows," he said, "but right now I'm here to support President Biden." In Nevada, he said, "I would never rule out anything in life." His political ambitions could put him on a collision course with two fellow Californians, Harris and Governor Gavin Newsom. Khanna said he has a cordial relationship with the vice president, and when he and his wife married, she sent him a nice note. Weaver, who advised Dean Phillips in his bid against Biden, but has since endorsed the president, says he encouraged Khanna and others to run this year if Biden didn't. "I think Roe Khanna could be an incredibly strong candidate in a presidential primary in 2028, he added. The first and only House member to leap directly to the presidency was James Garfield more than 143 years ago. A congressional representative would be an underdog, Khanna replied. But after Obama and Trump, I don't think there's any conventional path in politics. The description sounds a lot like Khanna. I've been an underdog in almost everything I've done politically, he said. He'll have to get through the Israel-Hamas war first. Our next article is Two Dead as Tornadoes Blast Oklahoma. More forecast for states in the Midwest. This article is written by John Bacon and Jorge L. Ortiz. A swath of the Midwest braced for more deadly storms Sunday after 2 days of brutal weather blasted across Nebraska, Iowa, Texas, and Oklahoma, killing at least two people, destroying homes, and knocking out power to thousands. The storm system threatened parts of Texas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Kansas, Missouri, and Iowa through Sunday night, AccuWeather warned. In Oklahoma, emergency management officials reported at least two deaths in Hughes County after storms and suspected tornadoes swept through the area Saturday into Sunday, according to multiple media outlets. Storm damage was also reported in the Love County town of Marietta. Another suspected tornado roared through Dixon County, which just 4 months ago was hit by a tornado driving winds up to 125 miles per hour. At midnight, the Weather Service warned on social media, "Dixon, this is a very serious situation. Seek shelter now." Close to 80,000 homes and businesses remained without power in Texas and Oklahoma by noon Central Daylight Time Sunday. In Nebraska, the National Weather Service office in Omaha had said more storms could develop by late Sunday morning and that the worst weather was expected Sunday afternoon. A hazardous weather statement for parts of Nebraska and Iowa warned that strong to severe thunderstorms may develop with wind gusts to 60 miles per hour, hail up to the size of quarters, and a tornado or two. "We have yet another risk for severe weather today," the Weather Service in Omaha posted on social media. "Keep an eye on the weather, especially if you'll be outdoors." The National Weather Service in Des Moines said preliminary reports indicate at least 10 tornadoes struck central Iowa during Friday's storm front, based on initial damage information. Severe storms may develop after 3 p.m. Sunday with some uncertainty, the agency said on social media. If it does, large hail is the main threat, with damaging winds and a few tornadoes as secondary threats. In Nebraska's Douglas County, which includes Omaha, chainsaws buzzed as residents cleared debris. Sheriff Aaron Hansen lauded locals for their efforts, but urged the curious to stay away to allow roads to be cleared and cleanup to continue. A tornado of this size hits major urban area, causes major damage with no confirmed deaths or serious injuries. Thousands of people turn out to help, he said in a social media post. Is this God reminding us that we need to be kinder to one another? Thunderstorms could develop across the Mississippi Valley to the Gulf Coast on Sunday and into Monday, posing another risk of severe weather hazards, such as hail, gusty winds, and flash flooding, AccuWeather said. Localized wind gusts of up to 65 miles per hour will be possible, with peak winds up to 75 miles per hour. While much of the plains catches their breath, the Mississippi Valley will become the focus for flooding downpours, strong winds, and hail. A tornado or two still cannot be ruled out, AccuWeather senior meteorologist Bill Deeger said. He added that torrential rain is the biggest concern from the system approaching the lower Mississippi Valley and southern states, possibly affecting population centers such as Jackson, Mississippi, New Orleans, and Mobile, Alabama. Our next article is Heart Pump and Pig Kidney Save Grandmother. Near death, surgery gives woman new lease on life. This is written by Karen Weintraub. A 54-year-old New Jersey grandmother was days or weeks from death earlier this month when she became the fourth person ever to receive an organ from a pig. Lisa Paisano was suffering from heart failure, needed regular dialysis, and had just fallen and broken her foot when she arrived at NYU Langone Health. She'd been increasingly sick for years, suffering multiple heart attacks and a bypass surgery. She needed both a new heart pump and a new kidney, but because she was on dialysis, she wasn't a good candidate for the heart pump. And because of her heart problems, she wouldn't have qualified for a kidney transplant, said Dr. Robert Montgomery, chair of the Department of Surgery and director of the NYU Langone Transplant Institute. She was in a catch-22, he said. Paisano was given two choices. She could accept her fate and say goodbye to her beloved grandchildren, or take a chance on an artificial heart pump, plus a kidney from a gene-edited pig. She opted for the chance. On April 4th, surgeons implanted the heart pump, a device called a left ventricular assist device, or LVAD. She was placed on continuous dialysis and bed rest for 8 days before receiving the pig kidney on April 12th in a surgery Montgomery led. In addition to showing the viability of the pig kidney, the procedure also shows that LVADs can be used successfully in patients on dialysis, Montgomery said. Maybe some will get human transplants because now we've shown that an LVAD can support a kidney transplant, he said. No one really knew that. Paisano volunteered for the surgery to help herself, and because if it didn't work for me, it might have worked for somebody else. Her health had started to go downhill in 2017 after her first heart attack and got progressively worse. She had worked in retail at Kohl's and Walmart over the years, but had to quit. Her life got smaller and smaller. In recent months, she couldn't even go shopping with her daughter. When Montgomery explained the double procedure to her, she saw it as her only opportunity to extend her life, so she took it. That was that, Paisano said. She said she isn't bothered at all by the idea of having a pig part inside of her. She doesn't eat bacon anymore because of the salt, but she used to be a fan. Asked if her family members were cracking jokes about it. They better not, she said. Her recovery is slow, but she's not in a lot of pain, she said. She's been getting daily physical therapy and taking a few steps with a walker. Her main goal, she said, is to get back to playing with her two grandchildren and cooking for her husband. Just living a normal life. More than 100,000 Americans wait on organ transplant lists, and others would join those lists if they could. But thousands of people die every year waiting for an organ, and others who are lucky enough to receive one suffer from organ rejection or from the immune suppression used to prevent rejection. Montgomery, who led Pisano's kidney transplant, hopes the pig organs he uses can solve both problems. There are several competing models for pig organs, one used at NYU and another used at Massachusetts General Hospital, which performed the first live kidney transplant from a pig in March. The pig used by Mass General, created by a company called eGenesis, was a cloned animal with 69 gene edits. That procedure seems to have gone well, saving the life of Richard Rick Slayman, a Massachusetts man who was released from the hospital about 2 weeks after the procedure. Now, 7 weeks after the surgery, Slayman continues his recovery at home. The NYU pig had only one single gene removed, which would otherwise cause the human body to immediately reject the pig organ. Lacking just one gene, the pig can be bred through normal reproduction, which is cheaper and easier to do at large scale than cloning, Montgomery said. Along with its kidney, the NYU pig, bred by United Therapeutics, also provided its thymus, an organ of the immune system. Adding the pig's thymus, Montgomery said, should protect the pig kidney from being attacked by the human immune system. Hopefully, this will eventually allow doctors to reduce the medication all transplant patients have to take to limit the risk of organ rejection. The same medication that saves the organ also can damage it long term, though, and by suppressing the immune system, increases the patient's risk for infection and some cancers. One of the reasons we've come up with this simpler gene edit and thymus transplant, Montgomery said, is to address the two biggest problems in transplantation, lack of organs and immunosuppression. But all of this is theoretical until it's tested in people. Tests have been ongoing in primates for more than 5 years, and in decedents or brain-dead people on life support since 2021. So far, the Food and Drug Administration has allowed pig organs to be tested in 4 living people. 2 received pig hearts at the University of Maryland in 2022 and 2023, but survived less than 2 months each. It's too soon to know whether the 2 patients who received pig kidneys will fare better, but the heart patients were likely sicker to begin with, Montgomery said. Researchers had assumed human patients would be easier to keep alive with organs from pigs rather than primates. But Montgomery said the deaths in Maryland showed that they essentially will have to start over in people, trying to understand how best to manage the risk of rejection and other challenges. I think we're at the beginning of really understanding what is going to happen in humans, he said. I don't think it's going to look that much like primates. It's going to be a really different game. And that's all the news I have today on Monday, April 29th, 2024. This is Deborah Weinstein. Thanks for listening and have a great day.